CliffCentral.com. All right, good morning and welcome to the Burning Platform. It is what we do on a Thursday, and we try to find the smartest and most informed and most interesting and most analytical people we can, and people who are analytical in a particularly useful way. And the grand dame of South Africa's journalists, I would like to think that that's what she is. I certainly think she's done an incredible job of reporting over the last couple of years, managing newsrooms over the last couple of years. She is also, while all of that's been going on, been writing book after book, and all of them are absolutely terrific. She is none other than Ferial Hafaji, who joins us today. Pumi and I have both got our copy of The Days of Zondo. Ferial, it's so good to see you again, and thank you for this excellent and seminal work.
Thank you very much, Gareth, and for your kind words. I'm going to put it on a poster. Good morning, Pumi. Look forward to chatting to you today.
So, Ferial, it really is. It's great to see someone who can, you know, this is why we need journalists. And I know that this is something that you've been working hard on, apart from all the other things you've been working on for the last couple of years. You've done a tremendous job of reminding people of why journalism matters. And your book is a condensation and a compilation of what the average South African either might not have the time to do in terms of the heavy lifting and the paying attention to detail and the mapping out of how the commission has done its work and what exactly has happened. Or it might be stuff that is just too complicated for us. And you've gone and you've condensed it into this book, which really gives us, and Pumi's a total Zondo Commission nerd, by the way. So she had to watch.
Oh, are you, Pumi?
Oh.
Are you? Excellent. Pumi. I'm so happy to hear.
We ran for how many years was it? We always had like a little snippet of days of Zondo, all of the shenanigans happening. So I really enjoyed reading this book because reminded me of some of the things that I had forgotten. Mm-hmm. And also I think it gave a true roadmap of what went down at the commission. And there are still many more questions than there were answers given, and there couldn't have been answers to everything. But I think that with the book, as it really does lay out in an almost straight line some of what we should really be paying attention to.
Thank you.
But I don't know to what end, which is what I'd like to ask you. To
absolutely.
What end? To what end?
I suppose the book started beginning to look at those questions. So I looked at a lot of people doing the perp walk and try to capture photographs of them in court, because I think things have started happening. So there is an end. But I think really coming to a point of justice, or us feeling like that was a lot of waste of money, and actually it's just continuing and continuing, I thought the process was valuable to document, and also to remember the heroes who really took their lives into their hands often, to give us the foundation of that story. And then obviously the journalists who brought us the Gupta leaks, and a week after week after week of revelations before it was institutionalized into the public protector's investigations.
One of the best things about this book is these beautiful infographics that you've got in there, and you mentioned the heroes. Let's not forget the big hero in the story is the man who commissioned this commission, and that was Jacob Zuma, ironically. You know, he's the person who put it into place. But you do talk about journalists, you talk about Skonati Manchansha, and you talk about the Gupta Leaks team, the SABC8, the guys who you work with at the Daily Maverick in Amabungane, News 24, Branko from the Daily Maverick, and obviously lots of whistleblowers, you know, great people, Temba Maseko. We've got incredible people here that have done a tremendous amount to help us, Brian Curran, obviously, to help us understand what was going on. Athol Williams, who's been a guest on this show a couple of times. And I was pleased to hear the president on Monday. So if you don't mind, can we start there? Because it seems we can start at the end and work backwards. So the president called a family meeting, and everybody thought it was going to be about Eskom. A few people seem to have known that this was what it was. And I think maybe we're all sitting here going, okay, look, the president's between a rock and a hard place. His own party is busy trying to figure out where it's going to go in the next election. There are massive factions at work and moving the whole time in the ANC. Was he between, was he forced to make a call on this and to seem like he's going to act upon it? Maybe he will. We can only hope. And do you feel that this comes from a kind of a long game analysis of what Cyril's done in his presidency, which a lot of people have started saying can't possibly be the truth? You know, he didn't have a plan all along. Or is this just desperation because he's also realized, like, if he doesn't act quickly, his enemies will. And maybe that's forced his hand in all of this. He's got the commission. The commission's given him all the reports. It's comprehensive. Judge Zondo's done an amazing job. What made the president call that meeting and talk to us for 2.5 hours the other day?
Sure. So he was bound by the terms of the commission to respond in a specific period, and that period was October the 22nd at midnight on Saturday, and so he had to tell us on Sunday. But what was important is he could have taken much longer. This commission was delayed 7 times, so my own view was the president was only going to tell us his response in about April next year. Actually, he met his deadline. And if you read the 77 pages, it's a very considered response. We can argue with parts of it, as I'm sure we will. But for me, it felt like the continuation of a long game that he continues to play or bat in very, very trying circumstances. So on Sunday night, Gareth, I thought he looked exhausted because I realized he had just come out of a weekend meeting where the ANC really is taking scythes to many parts of this commission's work, saying the judge overreached. He had no right to go there. There's absolutely no way we're doing it away with CADA deployment. He's got people named in the commission who are top of the slates that are emerging for the December conference of the ANC. So I thought under the circumstances, it was a work that he was bequeathing to the people, to the institutions, and say, yeah, I've done it. You need to run with this now.
You know, you say he looked exhausted. I think our president always looks exhausted, and maybe he also always looks disinterested. I think more than exhausted, which is one of the things that, again, over the weekend there was so much flurry of presidents talking over the weekend, and it was
was all of them. I had to go.
Yeah.
Shame, I missed Ivy Matsipika Saburi. But one of the things that I absolutely loved in your book, which where it starts, is reminding us also that in the almost 30 years of ANC government, we have had a scandal.
Yes.
There's no shortage of commissions. There's no, like, we have had scandals, and I had even forgotten about the Sarafina 2 scandal.
You remember Sarafina? and Moteo housing scandal. We didn't.
And when I saw that in your book, I was just so mad, because really and truly, what the commission also demonstrated, I think, for some of us that, you know, don't have the very short memory that most South Africans seem to have, is it demonstrated how ingrained in this party scandal, fraud, and theft and treachery actually is. I mean, you talk about how in the lists, I cannot even believe that we are having a conversation that says Zweli Mkhize could stand to be the president. This is a man who, at the height of a pandemic, is part of stealing hundreds of thousands of rands that were meant to help. And here we're having a conversation this man could become the president of the party.
In the president's office, his spokesperson was stealing money, remember? I just want to play you a clip of Thabo Mbeki that was circulating yesterday. I think Herman Mashaba put this out on Twitter. And it might be worth just watching what he has to say, because this is quite scary. I'm not sure when he said it, but it's certainly applicable to exactly what you guys are talking about. Take a look at this quickly. This is former President Thabo Mbeki.
We agreed with them. We didn't campaign. The reason we didn't campaign is because if we campaigned and won, we would put in authority in the leadership of the municipality people who are criminals. They are ANC, but they are our leaders. That's why we decided not to campaign. We said we can't. We can't campaign for the ANC to win, because the ANC to win in Newcastle means to put a criminal there in the leadership of the municipality. We can't do that. And the fellow is talking, he says, you know, these people of ours, comrades, who've been in charge of this municipality, they actually have on their payrolls Izinkabi. You know, these professional killers. They are paid monthly. So they are held in reserve, so that one day I'm going to say, go and kill so-and-so. They say they are actually paid by the municipality, our people, retainers.
Now it could be old, but it's still relevant to what we're talking about these lists and these criminals on the lists that Ferial mentioned.
Yes.
You know, here's Thabo Mbeki saying, Izinkabi, the professional killers, have been on the payroll when they went to campaign for the municipality in Newcastle, and I'm sure that this is happening in other places too. We know Mpumalanga has had more than its fair share of political killings, parts of KZN too. So the ANC is so rotten from within that it's very, very difficult to imagine that the president's going to have any support for this, or that Judge Zondo won't have an uphill battle even being heard in some parts of the ANC.
So, it's true what the former president said there. In KZN, you've got business forums. Those are the people who shake down building sites, fiber installations, etc. Those people, there's a definite parallel with them and with the leadership of branches in the ANC and KZN. So that's the province where you see the pattern most acutely, but also in the northwest and then in Mpumalanga. So definitely criminalization of branches of the ANC, tenders put their way, absolutely. So therefore, I think that any action out of this document is going to have to come from Andrea Johnson, the head of the investigating directorate, and her team. And it's going to have to come from civil society keeping a very clear look at those recommendations and almost treating them as a report card that we, and I include myself in civil society, have to keep going back to. Because I do think you're going to see at the ANC conference come December, a lot of smack spoken about this report, and also people pushing against the step-aside rule in the ANC, and then much rhetoric about how the judge has overreached and done things he wasn't asked to. Actually, if you read the terms of reference, he stuck very closely to them because he is a lawyer.
Huh? As a journalist, Ferial, and you say that part of you include yourself as civil society,
yes,
that has to keep watch and kind of be a guard against railing on the report. When you were writing this book and also reporting on some of the days of Zondo, what were some of the things that, even for you, as close as you were just beyond mind-blowing that this is what happened?
So much I could stay with you for a good while. But I suppose the day that really taught me things was when Dudazani Zuma came to give testimony. And he was there on quite serious allegations. You know, he's a business partner of the Guptas. There were allegations that he had been the link man for the offering of bribes to Mqhibisi Jonas and two other people whom he had brought to the Gupta mansion, where one of the hapless brothers would offer them these enormous amounts of money. So he came that day to answer these serious questions. And what struck me that everyone at the commission, except the judge, was starstruck by him. People were like staff members who I'd seen being very correct lawyers coming around and asking for selfies. So it's a little bit like the story of Edwin Sodi, one of the key figures in the Free State. Is I think we have created heroes of the people who lead these bands of capture almost. And I asked the judge about this, and he said that we had, as a society, normalized the fruits of capture and the kind of characters who lead it, the public ones we know very well. And for me, that was really interesting to learn. And then, of course, the sitting on the edge of my seat moments was Angelo Agrizi showing us the videos of the money being counted in the 9 vaults at Bosasa. And then I was fascinated and compelled by everything that Noma Ngoma told us of what she knew, because she had such a ring of authenticity and anger and peak behind it that it for her, for me, she was the key witness along with Agrizi.
Huh? I'd forgotten about her, but my God, that was earth-shaking. Now, I've got a clip of our favorite former president, the one who is at the top of this pyramid of state capture. He was celebrating just this week, and someone took a video of him having a nice meal. I think it's a milkshake. I just want you to see this because why not celebrate? Pumi, you were saying last Thursday how thrilled you were to see him happy and dancing. And
I did not say I was thrilled. I did not say I was thrilled. I was actually quite stunned that nobody said anything other than how horrendous of him to be having such fun.
I want you to enjoy this moment where Gedlehlekisa is enjoying himself a milkshake and some well earned freedom. Take a look here. This will put a smile on your face. Here he is. Look at him. There he is. He's got a Coca-Cola. He's got a nice milkshake. I think, you know, look, he's relaxed. He's happy. It's just a very, you know, what a happy situation.
Look at that.
Happy man, just having a good time. So I thought that was important, and we needed to reflect on that. Because
Suncoast Casino.
He's clearly not concerned about the Zondo report or about President Ramaphosa's comments on Sunday. Now, I mean, that's directly after that they released this video, which is just to say, we don't care, this is not important to us, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the day before, the former president came to the Maslow in Sandton and rambled on for hours. It was clearly in anticipation of the Zondo report coming out on Sunday. I think what he was saying, the subtext of what he was saying to us is, don't even touch me, because remember July last year. I mean, that constantly is a threat.
July last year was an absolute failure if it was meant to be some coup d'etat. It dissolved and demolished itself under its own weight within seconds. I mean, it wasn't a particularly successful operation. It seems to have been very badly handled. And, of course, our intelligence services could have done a much better job, as could our security services, our what do they call it, criminal justice system.
But we were pretty, the country was, for me, it felt like it teetered. Yes, it petered out quickly, but it was a show of force. Huh?
I have, there are two questions that I have, and Farrell, I think you're possibly the only person that can help us of all the people we've had on the show. Why does the media continue showing up to Jacob Zuma's press conferences? Why?
No,
why is it given this platform?
I don't know if it's like shrunken newsrooms but as I was watching parts of the streaming on SABC, I wondered, would the BBC have given Liz Truss open mic to just go on about what had happened to her and how awful everything was? Would you see CNN giving Donald Trump 2 hours to just roll on and rave and attack people? They would mediate that conversation if they do cover it. and there would be a critical lens if they did cover it. And yet, yeah, I felt like he was just allowed, he was allowed to make it the national address that Mzwanele Mani boosted it as on social media.
And this was the third time.
Are small. I know, it keeps happening, huh?
It was the third time. It was initially slated to be on Wednesday or Thursday, and that got kind of cancelled at the last minute. And the next day, on the Friday, it was supposed to happen, and then they had technical to keep sending journalists. I was just like, why do we give this man the time of day? He should be allowed to have a YouTube channel on YouTube, but why must he be on the national platforms? But also, on the other side, the president rambled on also for 2.5 hours and then didn't take any questions. Why does the media allow him to not take any, you know, he should also be sanctioned. All the newsrooms should say, you actually have to take questions, you have to answer some questions, or you're not going to, you must send us the press release. Must send out a press release.
No, the way I've seen it in newsrooms is, the Jacob Zuma Foundation puts out a press release or a notification and people run. It's top of the agenda. I don't understand it. I don't think you can say, okay, just ignore them, because when I was at City Press and we used to cover Julius Malema a lot, people would say, if you just don't give him the airtime, he'll go away. That wasn't true either, because we live in a social media era now. But I did think that it needed to be mediated and understood, and perhaps not to give him hours and hours of time, because you don't see that happening on the better broadcasters. Huh?
Well, I mean, that's a whole other thing, because now we have to talk about the NPA. And this is something all the things that the president said, and I watched as much of it as I could stomach on Sunday before I eventually realized that I was going to run out of battery because I was experiencing load shedding, which many of the people in the country couldn't watch the speech.
Stage four at the same time. Hey,
ridiculous.
That was a story.
So, Ferial, what happens now? Because the NPA have been nothing if not underwhelming for at least the entire time that we've had this current NDPP. You know, we've spoken about her God knows how many times on this show, and everybody's constant comment is like, when are we going to get some action? Is there any insight you can give us? Is there any good news? Is there stuff happening there? Are there good people who are being brought in to make sure that the net closes around some of these people? And are we eventually going to see some of them in orange uniforms? I know that these are the rantings of people who are impatient and expect immediate justice, and these things take time. But is there any hope at all in the National Directorate of Public Prosecutions?
You know, I think there is, I do believe there is hope, and I can give you some numbers to underpin that. At the launch of my book in Joburg, Andrea Johnson attended. She's the boss of the Investigating Directorate. Now, if you want to see a no-nonsense, you really don't want to meet her in court woman, then it's Andrea Johnson. So they've got 26 cases ongoing at the moment, and I think about just 130 people, linchpins of state capture, who have been charged. And every so often you'll see them flashing across our screens. You've got Brian Molefe, Anoj Singh, recently appended Salim Issa from his hidey hole in Dubai. You've got McKinsey now added to that case. In Estina, you've got Ace Mahashule regularly in court and using all his money there, but I see he's back on the agenda for the ANC conference as well.
Yeah.
So cases have started. But the key question you get is, what about the big fish? To be honest, I don't ever think we're going to see the former president, Jacob Zuma, back in court on state capture charges. Or otherwise, he's going to do exactly what he's done with the tiny arms deal cases. I think people want to see the political mechanics, like your Malusi Gigaba, etc. They want to see them caught and in orange overalls. I think that's going to take a while, but a lot is happening. Andy Motibe of the SIU has been phenomenal and perhaps not celebrated enough. 4 billion rand back into SARS coffers docked from the people who were fingered at the Zondo Commission. So things have happened, and perhaps it's us as the media's job to kind of highlight that more often.
We had a whole episode.
We saw what happened.
Sorry, Pumi, go ahead.
So you just mentioned McKinsey being added to one of the cases. And we've watched, through no small efforts, Lord Peter Hain, what's happened with Bain. Do you think that there'll be any kind of any retribution to global players like McKinsey, like the banks who have managed to get all of this money out of the country?
Didn't the president say that they're going to outright ban some of these consulting firms from ever working with government again? Do you think that'll happen?
You know, the consulting firms are fighting back big time. Bain, for example, has been banned from government contracts. It's hired the most expensive lawyers in the country, and it's hired Tony Leon's Resolve Communications to do the kind of political legwork to get this overturned, because their contracts in South Africa are extremely valuable. They work for, I think their biggest at the moment is the Sasol contract. McKinsey is still very much in the picture. Just before my book came out, a South African official whom they'd hired to do spin for them phoned me and said, oh, I hope you're going to go easy on one of the big deals there, who's a South African guy, but now globally placed. So you can see they're working behind the scenes furiously. But last week, a book called When McKinsey Comes to Town came out.
I just finished it.
Did you finish it? For me, wasn't it like a shocker? And
what has happened to the big players at McKinsey who were integral to what happened at Eskom here in South Africa and Transnet?
Nothing.
Have just
zero.
Moved away, given their pensions, all the money onto them.
Like Vikas Sagar, the key guy here, real mover and shaker, knew everybody, big pump hands, chap, lived the high life here. He was just paid off and he started a very big fintech company in London. So there isn't really, they didn't feel to me a real action by McKinsey and Bain, except for spin and for covering their tracks and for shutting up journalists. Eh?
Yeah.
I do think that is something that I am trying to watch very carefully. There's also, of course, Swissport. There's the American aviation company, AAR. There are the Chinese rail companies who are really fundamental to the story. And sort of every so often I call up the Chinese embassy and say, you know, that 8 billion or so that was taken out of our country, have you done anything about that? And nobody ever answers. Huh?
Fariel, before I know we've got probably 30 seconds left with you, but something that I found quite fascinating early on in the introduction of your book, just talking about how apartheid capitalism was insulated from modernization, and how moving into the new South Africa, that culture was just transmogrified into a new language. I think, do you want to tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that, and that, you know, there's a need for a global rethink of how market powers work?
Sure. People don't like it when I say that. I think it's easier to think that said capture started with Jacob Zuma, it ended when he's gone, and now it's all okay. It's not. And I suppose what I learned by studying the process was how we didn't really shift how capitalism operates, its distribution of market power, and how do you and I understand that? Extremely high data costs, internationally high banking fees, super profits, and very high corporate pay. These are aspects that are under challenge around the world. And for me, it felt like we hadn't changed that modus. And so when the middlemen or the tenderpreneurs started doing it, we shouldn't be horrified, because all what they were doing was mirroring the practices that they had seen as they built their ambitions and their foundations.
Yeah, I mean, I was at a dinner last night that was hosted for journalists, and Evita Bezuidenhout was like the guest speaker slash entertainment. And you know, Tani Evita always speaks a little bit of truth where you least expect it.
Yes.
And said something along the lines of, well, you learnt a lot from the National Party, ANC, and they really did, you know.
Yes.
The ANC learnt a lot of their tricks.
They're very similar nationalist parties now. Huh?
Yeah. And this crony capitalism is not going away anytime soon. You can still see the way that big companies, the unions and government interact in a very cozy fashion with each other, cutting out small businesses, the consumer, the middlemen, the ordinary people of South Africa are trying to make a go of it. So I think that's a valuable point. Ferial, thank you so much. I'm sorry that I'm sorry we've kept you a minute or so longer than we should have. The Days of Zondo book is available. If you haven't seen it already on the shelves, Ferial Haffagy is the author, along with Ivor Chipkin, and it is all about the Zondo Commission. It'll give you the best possible oversight and concise view of what's been going on, because it really has been a long time, 3 years of slogging by poor Judge Zondo. He needs a holiday, don't you think?
He does. He's a kind guy. I don't think he's taking one. He's Chief Justice now. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank
it was
you,
lovely
Ferial.
To be
nice
with
to
you.
See you.
Thank you.
Ferial.
Bye-bye.
Haffagy. And, of course, you know Ferial Haffagy as a South African journalist, a newspaper editor, editor of the City Press newspaper from 2009 to 2016. Previously the editor of the Mail and Guardian, and currently associate editor at the Daily Maverick, and that is her new book. So, Pumi, I know you've been waiting to chat to our next guest. I thoroughly enjoyed my first conversation with him. His name is Dr. Alan Mendoza, and he is back because of popular demand and because he was so erudite about explaining what was going on in British politics the last time we spoke to him. He's the founder and executive director of the Henry Jackson Society, and he directs analysis, research focus, strategy, and development for the organization. The last time I spoke to him, Boris was about to be kicked out, and we had a really interesting discussion. Of course, a lot has happened since then, and we're on to Prime Minister number 3 since I last spoke to Alan. Alan Mendoza, it's good to see you. How are you, sir?
Hi, Gareth. Yes, fine, thank you. Hope you're well, too.
Very, very well. Pumi and I have been very keen to speak to you, and I'm glad that you could join us this morning. How many prime ministers are you expecting before the end of the year?
Well, at least as many as the late Queen, saw through in her entire 70-year reign, it looks like at the moment. No. Full end of the year, I think we're done.
All right. Well, let's start off with Rishi Sunak, who's become the new prime minister this week. He went to see King Charles at Buckingham Palace, and now he's going to set up a government of his own. Of course, the Conservative Party is still in dire straits. Just give us a little overview of Mr. Sunak, where he's from. Tell us a little bit about him, how he differs from perhaps his two predecessors, and whether or not he's got any hope in hell of holding this together.
Well, the last question is what everyone's asking. But, look, let's start with the facts. I mean, this is the son of immigrants to the UK. He is Britain's first Asian origin prime minister, so that's a major transformation. Of course, his parents came from East Africa originally, so you might say there's an African connection there as well, in that way. So quite remarkable story. His parents, you know, arrived, worked themselves up. They were in the health service and in various capacities. They provided for him. The education was key to what they wanted. He went to a very famous British public school called Winchester, and then went on to a stellar sort of academic career at Oxford and then at Stanford, and then, of course, famously into a career in banking. So he's had a very interesting upbringing, from not very much to quite a lot. He then, of course, famously also has married the daughter of an Indian billionaire, so that is, of course, a subject of some discussion. Became an MP fairly recently, only in 2017. So this is not a long, or 2015, one of the few, but it's not a long time in Parliament before he actually rose to the heights. He, of course, famously was our Chancellor during the COVID crisis, and as such, doled out billions of pounds to everyone to sort of, you know, save feeling through the pandemic. So he's really, you know, he's had an interesting background personally, educationally, from a family perspective, and of course politically. Now, he resigned from Boris Johnson's cabinet, did not win the summer leadership contest. We had that very unusual Liz Truss interregnum when she took over and he lost. It looked like his career was over, in a sense. And then suddenly, he's back in, because basically everything he said would happen with Liz Truss happened. I don't think anyone realised it would happen as quickly as that. And now he's been turned to by the Conservative Party in the hour of need, when the economy looks particularly damaged as a result of maybe what Liz Truss tried to do to it. But also, of course, the global situation that's going on, the commodity shortages, the war in Ukraine, the hangover from COVID, the inflation, the problems that we're seeing in many, many different countries, Britain, of course, has. And he's got to put that back together again now.
All right. So there are a few.
Now, Liz, why do you think, I have a question about the Liz Truss. Why Liz Truss fell apart so spectacularly and so quickly?
There are many questions about Liz Truss. We've all been asking.
But, I mean, she came in almost mirroring Margaret Thatcher, you know, so very similar policies, very similar stance and talk. So why did she fall apart so spectacularly?
Because she wasn't mirroring Margaret Thatcher, that's why. So, you know, you and I might say we're mirroring Margaret Thatcher by doing X and Y, but that's how she came in is not how Mrs. Thatcher came in. And I think she took the wrong lessons from the Thatcher era. It is true that Mrs. Thatcher fundamentally transformed the British economy and transformed the way we were trying to do business in this country. But she didn't do it on day one of her positioning in Downing Street. It was a long-term project that took multiple years to go through. And there was significant pain in that process. A little bit into the start of it. But it wasn't pain because of the way that she handled things. There were all sorts of structural problems in the British economy that she needed to undergo and remove. Now, the difference between her and Liz Truss is that Liz Truss came in, basically, and said, right, Thatcher did this, X, Y, and Z, I'm going to do it on day one. But she had forgotten that you have to, if you like, win the confidence of the financial markets to do these things. Thatcher, in the early 80s, managed to do that with a careful style of how she was doing things. Equally, people forget now, but in the mid-1970s, Britain, amazingly, had to go to the IMF, and the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, bailed us out because we were essentially bankrupt. So they had already told us we have to do this, that, and the other. So when Thatcher came in, she was acting on IMF advice, basically. And so the markets were like, right, this is fine, this is what we've asked you to do, essentially. What Truss came in and did was actually long-term sensible, trying to restore the idea of growth into the economy, trying to cascade money down, trying to drive productivity. But the way she did it was completely wrong. She didn't bring anyone with her. She didn't check out the policies beforehand. And crucially, she didn't balance what she was trying to do on supply-side reforms and with tax cutting with the means to pay for those tax cuts. So she was essentially loading debt onto the economy. And that was not something the markets were going to appreciate, given the volume of debt already there. So it was a fundamental misunderstanding of what Mrs. Thatcher did, I think, that actually did for her in that sense.
Yeah, it's interesting that the markets kind of came to bear there, and people forget what an important force that is. Because when we talk about the markets, we aren't just talking about rich people with capital. We're talking about the consumers, too, how much they're willing to pay, how much of an interest rate or an inflation rate they're prepared to accept. And people are taking a big hit at the moment. I mean, the cost of living crisis, as it's been named, is foremost in every politician's, or should be foremost in every politician's mind. I just want to go back to Rishi Sunak for a moment, because listening to you go through his CV very briefly, I mean, he sounds almost like the perfect candidate for the Conservative Party in some ways. He not only brings all of that elite institutional stuff which you need to have on your resume in order to be taken seriously in the Conservative Party, but he also brings, you know, a little bit of kind of second generation immigrant, first ever person of color in that role, stuff that the woke people on the left like too. So it might be in some ways a bit of a fresh breath of air for the Conservative Party. Do you think he's got enough support within the party though?
Well, I think you're right, first, about your prognosis. This is a really interesting departure and a number of firsts for the Conservative Party. You've got someone who clearly is experienced in the economy, if you like. You know, he's held that position. He's had a background in it.
Right.
He is at least steep, particularly at the time when there is a financial crisis, et cetera, economic crisis. So great, we've got someone who understands that at the helm. He's got all those other firsts as well. That's going to carry him, you know, a certain amount of the distance. But you know, the problem for him was that he didn't win the last contest against Liz Truss. He lost it. So now he's come in because he's been proven correct, if you like. So there's some strength in that. But the Conservative Party has to look at itself very hard in the mirror and decide, are we going to get behind this guy who is the right man for this job right now? We can see that. And can we make sure he's the right man going forward as well? And that's a question they have to answer, because they have basically removed two prime ministers in this year already, because they've lost confidence in them.
And Sunak is like sloppy seconds. I mean, he didn't win the vote. The other two dropped out. He's like sloppy seconds for them.
Well, no. In this case, it's not the other two dropped out. The other two couldn't get to the vote, and that's quite a different point. Mm. They didn't have enough support among MPs to get to the vote. And this is actually very important. I think the problem that happened last time was the MPs were not able to express a clear preference in the way that they voted. As a result, Liz Truss started with a lot of enemies, basically, people who were not backing her, and she didn't continue this well. She sacked her cabinet with loyalists, people who supported her, and sacked all her political enemies. Now, I don't need to tell you that if you've got a lot of enemies in the first place and then you sack them all as well a second time, they're not going to warm to you. They're going to try and bring you down. What Rishi Sunak has done, quite cleverly, I think, in his cabinet picks, is to bring all the different factions to sit round the table. He may not like X and Y. He may not like the person's stance on this or that, but he's brought them round the table to sit in and join in the cabinet. And that, I think, gives him a much better chance than Liz Truss, and actually, the end of Boris Johnson, of making a success of this and binding everyone to his policies. And that's what you've got to do as Prime Minister, bind people to your policies.
All right. All of this has happened without an election. We're not exactly sure how the British public feel about this. So it's an internecine battle in some ways in the Conservative Party. But what is happening with the rest of the political landscape? Have Labour even managed to take advantage of any part of this? Because the last time we spoke, Alan, you and I were both really quite shocked at how they hadn't managed to turn these obvious disasters in the Conservative Party into any kind of advantage for them in Labour. And has that changed at all, or is the Labour Party continuing its descent into stupidity?
Well, actually, the Liz Truss period was so damaging to the Conservatives that Labour have been able to take advantage, in the sense the polls were showing remarkable advantages to Labour. I mean, we had polls that were 32, 33, 34 percentage point leads. Now, that's better than what Tony Blair achieved in 1997, if you're thinking about polling leads. So what Labour has, I think, managed to do is establish itself as a viable opposition now. People have been willing to say, you guys are terrible, and we think that you're safe enough that we will vote for you. Because it's interesting, they're getting the votes, not the smaller parties. So clearly people have decided in some way, shape or form, the Labour Party is a party that they could support, they're interested and willing to support, and that is, I think, a big change for Labour from where it was, say, 6 to 8 months ago, where I'm not sure that was the case. Now, the challenge is, can Rishi Sunak pull that lead back, number one? Is it a soft or a hard lead? Because it might just be a soft lead that was just in revulsion of what the Tories were doing. If it is, then he's really in business, and then Labour have got a problem again. Or is it something that's going to be baked into the political system now for the next 2 years, in which case Labour will win the next election? But on that front, Labour still have not told people essentially what they stand for. And so I think a lot of this is actually soft support for the Labour Party that could go bad if Rishi Sunak does a really strong and good job straight away. So I think Labour have still a lot of work to do to convince the British people that they're a real competent, and I should say positive, force for government, rather than just the other guys who are going to vote for because you are so terrible.
I see that...
sounds like the problems we have here.
Yeah, well, politics is politics, isn't it?
Yeah. I see Rishi Sunak reinstated the fracking ban in a massive government U-turn on Sky News yesterday. And people are also concerned about his ties to the World Economic Forum and the fact that, during COVID, we saw so many of these World Economic Forum deployees all over the world acting like petty tyrants. Is there any concern around him behaving something like Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand? And what do you think of this fracking ban? Because clearly that is going to create an energy crisis on top of an energy crisis.
So I think it's a shame that the fracking ban's come in, because we've all understood in recent months, I think, that energy needs to be you know, kind of sort in whatever place you can find. If we have natural resources we can extract, we should be doing so rather than relying on external supplies of gas and oil. It doesn't mean in the long term you can't change your mix or look at, you know, doing that. But the reality is that we are in a pickle. In fact, much of the world is in a pickle because we're having to import yep. these natural resources. And as the argument was made recently, isn't it better, if you're going to use fossil fuels anyway, isn't it better to do it at home rather than shipping it over and doing, right. you know, where you can at least regulate it in that way? Look, that said, I understand why he did it. He did it because he is, in answering the sense to the previous question about, you know, elections, he has come in, the third Prime Minister in a year, and of course Labour are saying, you've got no mandate. Who are you? You know, the country elected Boris Johnson in 2019. Mm. What he has said is, no, the country didn't elect Boris Johnson. The country elected the Conservative Party and its manifesto pledges of 2019. Mm. And one of those manifesto pledges, to be fair, was no fracking. So what Liz Truss was doing essentially was changing that manifesto pledge that had been voted on by the British public. And I think what Rishi Sunak is trying to say here is, look, whatever the status of fracking, I have come to you on the basis of the 2019 mandate you gave my party. That's why I'm here, basically. So don't think I'm some bloke who's just been dumped into the, you know, number 10 Downing Street by anyone. I've actually come through that party that you voted for, and we're going to keep to the manifesto that you voted for to give myself legitimacy. And that's, you know, quite a powerful thing. And I don't think, actually, interestingly, I don't think he is going to be pushed around by anyone in the sense of he was very keen to open up the economy during the COVID period. As you know, we had a big debate about how early do we open up, how late. And in the end, the people who wanted it early won out here and took over from, if you like, the, you know, the sort of the health fascists who wanted everyone to be locked down forever. So I think actually his instincts on this are actually good, and he's not interested in listening to, you know, the sort of the very hardline, you know, forces who might want to keep people in check. He's interested, and he's always said he's interested in the idea of, you know, kind of economic freedom. But what he said is, and he's right again, we have to do it at a time the economy can actually allow for that rather than otherwise. We've got to build the ground for doing it, because right now, in the middle of 10% inflation, is not the time to run riot in this way.
And speaking of kind of power as well, one of the things that we know he's already done is he's already had his obligatory call with Joe Biden, and just talking about the kind of restating Britain's kind of commitment to sticking with America on this against Putin, and also to support the Ukraine.
By the way, I saw Biden call him Rishi Sunak or something, because he didn't even get his name right the first time he said, we've got a new prime minister. I mean, the guy's just completely out of it. So what is this? You know,
do you make of his stance with Ukraine and Biden's relationship?
Well, obviously the Biden relationship is very important for the UK, whether he's awake or asleep. I mean, we have to, you know, sort of be dealing with the US, whatever's going on, because, you know, this is our indispensable ally. We do things together. The whole world knows the UK and the US tend to stand together. So it's very important you make the call to the US president to say, look, Britain is back in business. We remain, you know, here. We remain your ally and partner on all these aspects of life, if you like. Here we are, willing to stand with you as usual in this kind of way. So it's, you know, hugely important. And I think it's particularly important that Rishi Sunak made that call, because he's got very little experience in foreign and defence policy. If you look at his entire political career, it's been focused on domestic activity. But we're in the middle of a war in Ukraine, a global war that involves, obviously, Vladimir Putin challenging the entire international system. So it's not only symbolic, but necessary for Rishi Sunak to present his credentials in this case and say, no, don't think I'm going to do anything different. I, too, am going to follow the line of Liz Truss and Boris Johnson. And to be fair, the entire British political class across parties, to say that what Putin has done is wrong. I will be pursuing justice for Ukraine, and we will be doing all that we can to support that embattled nation in concert with our many allies who are doing the same. So it's a vitally important thing that he is, kind of sketched out his policy on this, and obviously we're looking forward to what he might be doing in that area, particularly a lot of eyes on the 3% pledge that Liz Truss made to raise defence spending to that level of GDP. He's not guaranteed that yet. It's going to be interesting to see whether he does guarantee it or not.
All right, so Pumi also indicated the Russia-Ukraine situation. What is your take on all of that at the moment? I'm increasingly getting concerned that we're ratcheting it up. We're making it more and more aggressive on both sides. The West has been unequivocal about its support for Vladimir Zelensky and the Ukraine. And what is happening in Russia, obviously, is that they're becoming more and more like a bear backed into a corner. I don't see a way out of this. Do you?
It's a very difficult situation in the way that you suggested, because I don't think there's any problem with the West standing up for Ukraine, given the free world is under assault and we are the free world. We have to stand up for ourselves. We don't. History shows us that if the free world does not stand up for itself, the unfree world rolls it over, basically. And before you know it, you have the unfree world at your gate, basically. Better to stop it at its first infraction rather than its last infraction. You know, as Churchill once said, you know, the appeaser wants to feed the crocodile, hoping he'll eat him last, basically. Mm-hmm. That's the problem with appeasement. So we've got to stand up for that. And the Russian bear is poked into a corner, but it's been poked into a corner by its own idiotic activities. So it's the one that attacks Ukraine. It's the one that's now losing the war in Ukraine quite significantly. Mm. And we are worried, obviously, about the, you know, sort of the, where Vladimir Putin might take this conflict. It's difficult to see how he gets out of it now, isn't it? You know, he promised a victory to remove the entirety of the Ukrainian regime. Then he scaled it back to, oh, I'm just going to take over a few provinces. And now the Ukrainians are pushing him out of those provinces, which he claims are now Russia. This is obviously not a, you know, kind of sensible way. Realistically, if you look at where we can go here, I don't think you're going to see a negotiated settlement, because neither side can negotiate a settlement when they, you know, kind of can't afford to lose anything there. So your best bet, Gareth, to get out of this is that Putin is somehow removed from the scene. And I mean that. You know, if you look at how this likely ends, it has to be with Putin either dying or being removed from power by people in Russia who are appalled by either his incompetence or by the direction of travel. And don't forget that, you know, in the past, the Russians have done this. Khrushchev was a great example. Cuban Missile Crisis, he drags the world to the brink of nuclear war. He then loses the conflict with Kennedy, basically. And a couple of years later, the Politburo, you know, bring him into a room and say, it's all over, Nikita, off you go to a, you know, a small country, Dhaka, and we're replacing you with Brezhnev. So I suspect that, you know, that the way the war is, you know, being lost at the moment, there may well be people, even on the hardline faction, who say, this guy's failed us, or a collective of people saying, he's failed us, we've got to remove him. And I think that the likeliest outcome of this in a positive way would be for Vladimir Putin to be kicked out of office somehow, because that would enable a different constellation to emerge and for the war to end, basically.
So if the war ends, do you reckon, I mean, the amount of debt that the Ukraine is now under, even if the war were to end today, can the Ukraine come back and come out of all of that debt? Will they be able to?
Yeah, I think they probably will. It's not going to be an easy process, but I think because there'll be a big reconstruction program, I think much like Marshall Aid in Europe after 1945, if you look at what happened, you know, the US pumped billions into Europe to restore economies that were completely dead on their feet, basically, after 6 years of total war, and managed to get Europe up and running very quickly within 5 years, essentially. So if you have a plan, if you have the finance to do it, I don't see any problem with Ukraine coming back. Of course, it's been a terrible shock to their economy and to their system, but they will return, and there will be a way that they can do so. But they need the war to stop, obviously. They cannot do anything in the current constellation. They've got to have their territory back, their country back, and the ability to make decisions again without fear of Russian invasion.
Alan, it's always terrific to speak to you.
Okay,
do you want to throw something else
goodbye
in?
To Alan.
Okay, go ahead, Paul.
I have one question before you say goodbye to Alan. The World Cup, and I know this is not a Gareth type of question, but the World Cup is around the corner. What do you think England's prospects are? This is important. Well, it's an important question.
Well, look, anyone who's an England supporter has known that for years it's dangerous to make predictions about England and it's dangerous to dare to dream. But, you know, we came so close, you know, in the last major championships. We are so, the team is still, you know, bubbling along there. Hope springs eternal. We think it might be the time after, you know, how many years is it? Nearly 50 years, 60 years. Yeah. We're going to get there eventually and win the World Cup again and bring football home. You asked the right question.
Wow. All right, I'm glad you got that question in, Pums. And thank you, Alan. It's always terrific to have your insights into this really important stuff that's happening around it. Sometimes it's very confusing, and I'm sure not least to the people of Britain and to the Conservative Party and even to the Prime Ministers themselves. It must be very confusing. But thank you for helping us to understand.
The year of three Prime Ministers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes, it's like the year of three popes at once. I'm really great to join you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Alan Mendoza at the Henry Jackson Society, and he's coming to us this morning live from London. Very good to have him and Ferial Haffajee on. It's been a very busy Burning Platform this morning. Pumi, take a big deep breath. And
I'm off to get tequila, two shots, and then I'll be up for the rest of the day.
First thing in the morning. Sure, that's very brave. All right, we will see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. Thanks, everybody. That's the Burning Platform for this week. We'll be back with another one next Thursday. Cheers. Bye-bye. CliffCentral.com.